You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
As I said last week, democracy and by extension good governance presupposes the capacity of political leadership to engage in reasoned debate, informed decision making and measured judgments. And in the South African context, it's assumed that this will all happen within the framework of the Constitution. And in this way, democratic governance is premised on rationality and also proportionality, as evidenced by advocate Alfred Cockerill for British American Tobacco responding to government's medical arguments in the tobacco ban. It's not irrational to use a sledgehammer to crack a nut, he said, but it is unreasonable because there are less harmful ways of doing it. Constitutional Law 101 and Section 36 requires the court to consider whether there are less harmful ways to achieve the same results. And it's commonly believed that as rational beings, our thoughts and actions are informed by reason and logic that precludes the influence of emotions. But some of the regulations instituted under the National State of Disaster have really tested the limits of what can be deemed rational. And few issues have stirred as much heated and emotive debate than the banning of the sale of alcohol and tobacco products. A close second, probably the recent decision to close down schools again and allow taxis to operate at 100% capacity. But what the entire lockdown that gave rise to these regulations is premised upon are models that are now increasingly being questioned by actuaries as we've reached peak and plateau in the Western Cape, and increasingly it looks to be the case in Gauteng and the Eastern Cape in particular. And we are nowhere near the projected 40,000 deaths and the overrunning of our healthcare system that was predicted. I'm joined now by Nick Hudson, who's the CEO of Sana Partners and part-time coordinator of Panda. Nick, welcome. Last week, Panda, or the Pandemic Data Analysis Group, wrote a quite scathing letter to the South African COVID-19 Modelling Consortium. It was published on News 24, and it suggested that the consortium really reconsiders its methods, as its official model has now departed too far from reality to be useful, as you said. And the most recent official short-term predictive model was released on the 12th of June, and the current long-term model is dated on 6th of May. So perhaps that's a good place to start. The models are aging poorly. Let's interrogate why.
Look, I mean, the whole process from the beginning has been characterized by what I would say could be described as a departure from reality. You know, the initial models that came out had 88,000, 89,000 to 351,000 deaths for the country. And even then, I mean, it was a clear departure from all the available evidence, the Diamond Princess cruise ship experience, which was very important because it provided a kind of closed experimental condition kind of setup that gave you an idea about how bad things could get and you know, put a cap on the whole story, which according to us, you know, our interpretation of that 20,000 deaths thereabout for South Africa would have been about right, not 89 to 351,000. And then as data started emerging from the rest of the world, you know, to give you an idea, if South Africa performed in line with the worst country in the world to date, the worst large country, that would be Belgium, we would have about 12,000 deaths in this country. That's on an working from the Belgian experience, age adjusting it to reflect our younger population, 12,000 deaths. So 48,000 is four times the age adjusted mortality experience of the worst country in the world. And when you add to that the observation that it seems that, you know, developing nations have had overall lighter experience than the developed world, it's even harder to understand. And we've just been scratching our heads and wondering about this from the very beginning.
And if you look at the May model, for example, I think that predicted that by the 1st of August, we'd have somewhere between 3,386 and just under 35,000 deaths. Surely we could have had a narrower predicted range by now, given all of the evidence and the weight of evidence locally that we have to input into our models.
100%. There's absolutely no reason to be utilizing such wide confidence intervals. You know, it's been robustly demonstrated overseas that there's a family of curves that fits this epidemic. And when you're as far along the curve as we are in this country, you can get a whole lot tighter than those kinds of parameters. And it's just a question of, you know, these models seeming to be prepared in a vacuum and nobody sort of really seeming to bother to compare them to the actual real world information. It's as if they've sort of fallen in love with the mathematics of their models and forgotten to look up and see what was going on outside the window.
And that is a problem with the models. They are effectively just a guide. What are the flaws with the susceptible, exposed, infected, recovered model, the so-called SEER model?
So, yeah, I mean, it's a class of models and everybody has their own approach to it. But in general, what we found was when we tried to adapt SEER models to reflect the actual curves overseas, we couldn't even get them to fit. So there's something structurally wrong with those models. Some of it's not even just a question of the assumptions being wrong, because no matter what you made the parameters values equal to, you couldn't get the curves to fit those international curves. And so we rejected them altogether. We just didn't bother looking at them anymore. And I know other researchers who found the same. So we're not alone in saying this. Mm-hmm. We found that much simpler approaches, in particular the Gomperz curve method developed by Professor Michael Levitt of Stanford University. Those fitted perfectly well, and they have the joy of being delightfully simple models. So you don't need thousands of lines of complicated computer code to generate them. You can build them in a little spreadsheet, you know.
I'm reminded of what Jason Zweig, the author of The Devil's Financial Dictionary and well-known U.S. financial columnist, refers to models as they weapons of maths destruction, if not used correctly. Now, what exactly is the Gomperz function, and why is it useful in this instance?
Well, the question of why it fits is a fascinating one, and we're getting a little closer to understanding that, because it has to do with the dynamics of transmission. It has some implications, might I add. So the fact that it fits has implications for how this disease progresses through a population, and figuring that out is a fascinating process, not that easy. But you know, I totally agree with that comment about weapons of mass destruction. My day job is to has a lot of aspects that involve valuation of companies, and I always look at these complicated spreadsheets that the younger analysts will put together, and I'll say, you know, I've got a simpler model that's called a price earnings multiple, and that works fine for me for 25 years. You've got a problem, you know. it's no different here. You know, the more complicated and over parameterized the model gets, the less likely the operator of the model is, in my opinion, to actually, you know, stop and see what the real world consists of. And so you get this very divorced process going on. And this has not just happened in South Africa. I mean, our guys are not alone in this. You know, that started this way in the UK with Ferguson's massive prediction that the UK would have 500,000 deaths. I mean, it took months and months for the world to pass that total. So to say that it was out is to understate the case completely. He was out by like, you know, 1,000% too much, you know. So it's just been wall-to-wall modeler outrage. And the difficulty is, you know, if this was just like some kind of game, you know, then fine, okay, we can have fun in a university environment, and we can fit our curves and we can do all sorts of things. But when there are real-world consequences, as there are in this kind of situation, when very extreme countermeasures are being contemplated, it gets very serious very quickly. It becomes a matter of life and death. And you know, the staggering thing for me, I mean, we've used the word insouciance to describe the sort of this attitude of, well, you know, like, well, yeah, so what, you know? It's almost treated as if it's some kind of joke, you know? From the beginning, our first point at Panda was, when you shut down an economy, you take away people's livelihoods. When you take away their livelihoods, that has a mortality and a morbidity impact all of its own. Mm. And the calculations we did, to try and assess what the damage would be from a mortality perspective of lockdown, indicated that it wouldn't be less than 30 times as much loss of life that we were talking about. And, you know, when we look at the emerging excess death numbers, it seems to be, you know, corroborating that kind of approach that we took, which was to say, look, not only are your models getting the disease epidemics wrong, they're not taking into account the mortality cost of lockdown. You know, you should be modeling both sides of the equation
before
you make that decision. You don't just ignore
those unintended consequences. Can you expand actuaries that work on these kinds of things all the time for life insurers and the like on how you model life years lost?
Yes, I can give you a high-level analysis. The guys on my team are much closer to the details, so I'm going to do my best. But I mean, when you observe the nature of the person who tends to be afflicted by coronavirus, you can get a sense of, you know, how many remaining years of life they would have from an actuarial perspective, and you use underwriting tables to get a grip on that. It's not too complex, but a reasonably sophisticated process that involves that is used when insurance companies try to price insurance policies, taking into account a person's level of income and that kind of thing. So you would look at the comorbidities that a person has to see how many years of life they're typically losing in the event of a coronavirus death, and you would compare this to the income effect on mortality for a person who's knocked out of a job by lockdown, and you try and assess the ratio of the lives lost to lockdown to the lives lost to coronavirus. That's probably as good as I can do.
Any deeper than that, and I think you lose probably 90% of the population, unless you are one of those grey-shoed actuaries who likes to introduce themselves by looking at the other person's shoes. Now, the big issue we've had is around testing. And obviously, if you test more, you're probably going to pick up more cases. If you test less, you're going to pick up fewer cases. It's logical. So what we look at is reported COVID-19 deaths. And what we're seeing is that the reported COVID-19 deaths and the excess deaths are starting to diverge. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think we should correctly refer to some of those excess deaths as lockdown deaths. And, you know, that's not reflecting necessarily what's happening today. It's also reflecting the cumulative effect of the past months of lockdown, the losses of income, the denial of access to medical care. You know, that's an important thing. And it's not, you know, when I say denial of access, there are two components to that. It's what the hospitals are permitted and able to do under lockdown conditions, and also what people are prepared to do given the level of fear that has been created in part by these overwrought models. And so you've got, you know, cancer detection that hasn't happened, TB and HIV treatment and management programs that haven't proceeded. And then yesterday I heard a horrible one. One of the doctors in our team said they've just had this, you know, very significant increase in the number of amputations that are being conducted. And so I said to him, that surprises me. That wasn't what I had in mind with the lockdown situation. And he said, yeah, well, what's happened is, you know, your diabetic and vascular patients who often get these ulcers that, unless they're managed, can go out of control, have been sitting there through lockdown, too scared to go near a hospital, and their conditions get out of control. So they're now, what could be a completely treatable situation now turns into an amputation. And I just, you know, that's the kind of story that I find it very difficult to then understand, this kind of almost joking attitude that's taken by the modeling fraternity.
Considering that this is known, and you speak to any doctor and they tell you similar reports around people being too afraid to go and receive their usual care, can we call this an unintended consequence if it is and should be broadly known? At what point do we start to say, well, this is quite frankly negligence?
Well, I mean, the fact that we even put our first paper together proposing a method for calculating the consequences, maybe it's unintended, but it's negligently so, you know. And so, you know, it frustrated me at the time. You know, we did send our work to a great many people, including academics who we thought would know better. But, you know, the attitude we got when we built the thing as lockdown as a potential humanitarian crisis, the kind of response we would get, and I'll, you know, quote from one, was, I do not understand what you mean by humanitarian crisis. When I got that response, I remember my blood ran cold, because I thought, you know, these are people who should be able to understand the mathematics of what we're doing. It's not that complicated. It's, you know, the proposal that taking away a person's income also robs them of life is widely recognized.
Yeah.
And but the guys were almost like, it's a...
Well, I was going to say, I mean, the next CRAM study that was led by Nick Spall and other researchers has shown that 3 million people lost their earnings through the lockdown, and probably permanently so. A further 1.5 million people were furloughed, and we don't know whether or not they're going to be able to earn a living again. 4.5 million people, you take a multiplier effect, and you can just see the impact of this. And you speak to anyone about the need for food. People can't put food on the table. So I find it bizarre that they couldn't understand the humanitarian crisis nature of this. I have heard reports from some in the ivory towers of tertiary institutions and laboratories say that you're too white and you're too rude, which I find flabbergasting, to be honest, because what you're doing is presenting information, you're presenting it in a very calculated and dispassionate manner. Has anyone embraced you so far to say, well, come and chat to us and let's have another view?
Well, a few things to pick up on there. Ivory Tower is a problem here. Noting, though, the work that you cite, Nick Spall's work was excellent work. Okay, so let's acknowledge, let's give credit where it's due. That was a good, fine piece of work. But in general, I think, you know, that where we have become rude and a little bit angry from time to time. But I mean, you know, this is after months of trying to engage, you know, first out of the public eye and then in the public eye. So, you know, I'd like to ask a little bit of forgiveness for the occasional outburst of anger. But I mean, when you sit there pointing out the same thing, look, the models are wrong. Look, they're departing from the underlying reality. Look, there's a human consequence to lockdown, and nobody's modeling that, and nobody's calculating that. And there are these disproportionate, you know, to use your opening line of where's the proportionality, where's the rationality in these policy prescriptions? You know, the alcohol ban potentially takes a million robs livelihoods from a million people, you know. So yes, a little bit of rudeness, a little bit of brusqueness, which I kind of will not apologize for, you know. This is very serious stuff, and there's real world consequences. One thing that has increasingly struck me is that there's almost a level of ideological commitment to the original idea.
What we're seeing also with the statistics is that you can torture statistics until they tell any story you want them to tell. What are we seeing when it comes to the way the South African Medical Research Council is reporting excess deaths?
Yeah, in their initial report, when the excess deaths phenomenon was observed, there was this wording that we thought lent itself to misinterpretation, that the deaths would be interpreted as COVID deaths that hadn't been detected somewhere. And we were worried about that. Sure enough, there was a loud newspaper headline the next day. And yeah, subsequently in this sort of the third iteration since then, the SAMRC has begun describing those as being possibly caused by other things than COVID. And we're supportive of that interpretation. It does seem to be the case to us that these are definitely not a majority. The majority will be something other than COVID. And I think that's something to keep an eye on. I mean, we are obviously expecting that to be sustained at some level, very sadly so. It's one of those predictions you make in life that you really never want to be right about. But I think it is going to be coming through. And I don't think it'll take long for the total consequences of lockdown to overwhelm the consequences of coronavirus. And I mean, there's a bit of a, you know, when the report first came out, there was an actual attempt to plug the gap between the forecasts and the reported COVID deaths using those excess deaths, a graphical attempt, you know, which we responded to with quite a bit of anger, because it was kind of like, you know, you make the one prediction that the models will be wrong. You make another prediction that there will be excess deaths from non-COVID causes. And then there's this sort of rather galling attempt to plug the one gap with the other, you know. We'll see how that emerges. If I'm a betting man, I think we're right.
On the alcohol ban, and that's another issue that's really raised temperatures, recently the alcohol industry issued a release in which they state, and I quote here, "The initial estimates used by the South African Medical Research Council for the modelling of the potential number of reduced trauma unit presentations is based on data from roughly 356 secondary and tertiary public hospitals in 1999. And the reason for each trauma is not captured by the hospitalization data provided, is not notifiable. So one also has to ask serious questions around the modeling, both using age data sets and also the fact that it's not notifiable when you reported trauma, whether or not it was a result of alcohol.
You know, absolutely, I agree with you asking that question. But again, it's another illustration of what happens when you put people in a room who are of the same type and ask them to solve a complex problem. You need diversity in the room. And the SAMRC, the M stands for medical. So they look at the trauma ward and come to a medical judgment that, yes, these alcohol deaths are taking up some beds. Now, fair enough, they are, you know. But where's the person in that room pointing out that there are 120,000 jobs at stake or more and a million livelihoods at stake, and pointing out that economically it's a cinch to solve the couple of hundred oxygenated beds that would be required, you know, to be supplemented for COVID purposes if the hospitals were overburdened, which they aren't, okay? You know, and again, you see how these things all fit together. The modelers are telling you they're going to be overburdened. So you start trying to cut corners. But we are not in such a position. The Western Cape is 6 or 7 weeks past its peak. Eastern Cape's past its peak. South Africa is probably past its peak. Gauteng soon, you know. So, I mean, these projections are just not being fulfilled. But they put the pressure on the SAMRC. SAMRC tries to come up with ways to cut the hospital beds. There's no one in the room representing, you know, the people who are going to be out of jobs, the hundreds of thousands of people who are going to have their, maybe even a million people who are going to have their livelihoods removed for 3 months and the health consequences of that. And, you know, it's a repeating question. You have this situation where a very complex problem is being solved by people who have expertise in a narrow field. And then on top of it, quite a supercilious attitude towards anybody from a more generalist perspective who's putting their hand up and saying, you might not be seeing the bigger picture. So it's very much a microcosm of the broader lockdown problem. You know, the same coronavirus epidemic under a microscope, lockdown without thinking about the consequences of lockdown, potential hospital bed shortage because of those overwrought models, knee-jerk reaction, shut down the entire alcohol industry. And, you know, you can see the thought process. The person sitting there saying, well, we're asking people to stop drinking for a couple of months. You know, in the context of an epidemic, that's not such a bad thing. You know, that's the kind of, you can imagine the person's headspace. But if they stop to think about, you know, the downstream stuff, the logistics industry, the restaurant bosses, industry, yeah, all of the dependents, yeah, goes on and on and on.
It really does. And it brings, you know, to a conclusion our conversation. We've got three more minutes into question and sharp focus this issue of transparency and accountability here, Nick. And we had government just last week saying that it's not going to be making any of the advisories made by the Ministerial Advisory Committee public, number one. And number two, there doesn't seem to be any transparency inside the NCC as to who's going to be held accountable when the economic Armageddon that is being predicted just in yesterday's FM eventually arises here. What's your take on the lack of accountability here? Surely we need to see and be demanding as citizens the decisions made public. If we've given away our civil liberties, if we've done this damage to the economy and people's livelihoods and the life years lost as you've modeled, one has to have a really serious interrogation after all of this to ensure that at least we have some form of accountability.
Look, I mean, those minutes are subject to public access to information processes right now, so hopefully they will see the light of day. The reluctance to have them see the light of day, I have three theories on that. I can imagine that there's embarrassment potentially to the extent that the right questions weren't even being asked by the scientists, you know, so that these issues that I've been raising now will be absent from the discussion or the recordal of events. I can imagine also that there would be embarrassment owing to some very challengeable statements having been made. So, for example, the effectiveness of lockdown in terms of flattening the curve. I think, you know, the NRCD has made certain claims in that regard, which I do not think bear inspection, you know. So there's been, in our view of the world, some bad advice given, which would then be exposed. And then there's probably good advice given, the third category, good advice given that is not followed by the NCC. So those three things would be my explanations for why there is reluctance to part with those minutes. There's certainly not any kind of confidentiality or that needs to be observed in this kind of situation. I think the need for transparency goes up when you're robbing citizens of livelihoods and taking extreme steps that curtail their rights in a profound way.
Absolutely. We'll be following that PIE application process with great interest. Nick Hudson, CEO of Sana Partners and part-time coordinator of the Pandemic Data Analysis Group. Startling stuff. We're going to have to leave it there. Thanks for your time.